Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
I was asked last week by a woman who will remain anonymous, but her initials are Deborah Finnemore. And she came up to me and she said, "What is the deal with you and Christmas? Why?" See? "Why are you such a curmudgeon about Christmas?"
That's your word. I didn't use that word.
You did not use the word curmudgeon. I agree.
I was quite nice about it.
She was very nice about it. She was very kind about it. "What is your deal with Christmas?" And I understand, there are a lot of folk who are very big on Christmas, very positive on Christmas, really enjoy the Christmas season, and I understand that, and I would never get in the way of your enjoyment of Christmas. But I'm just going to take 5 minutes at the top here and explain what is my deal with Christmas. It's just that when I was a kid, my parents really committed to the Santa Claus myth. I mean, really committed. I mean, like leaving out milk and cookies, and we get up the next day, and the cookies have been eaten, and the milk was gone, and we got the stuff we wanted. I was convinced, later in life than most kids are, that Santa Claus still existed. I didn't give up Santa Claus till I was 23. And so, no. But in any case, I was reasonably old as a child before I gave up the Santa Claus idea. When my parents realized that it was time to tell Jim the truth because he was too old to go on believing this thing and that he was eventually going to get, you know, teased on the playground and get his lights punched out, that it was time to tell Jim the truth. And so they told me, "Look, there is no Santa Claus, it's us. We bought you the stuff, we ate the cookies, we did the stuff and everything." I cried. I was horrified at the idea that Santa was not real. And actually said to my parents, and they will attest to this to this day, you can check with my mom, the very next question out of my mouth was,
"I know who it is.
Is Jesus real?
Well then, is there a God?" Yeah. Because they were also dragging me to Lutheran church every week. And Lutheran church seemed to have the same sort of benign traditions. And, you know, I knew how to do the whole liturgy. I didn't even have to open the book. I knew when to stand up, sit down, fight, fight, fight. I knew when to do all this stuff. You get the little 15-minute homiletic sermon that usually didn't mean anything, wasn't about anything. And so Santa Claus, I had evidence for. I had proof for that. I got gifts. He ate the cookies. He drank the milk. He'd been in the house. I have proof for Santa Claus.
He's on the news.
He's on the news. Oh, I mean, you get the weather guys tracking him from the North Pole every Christmas Eve. And there was a whole society telling me Santa Claus is real. Every store you walk into, it's Santa, Santa, Santa. And he knows when you're sleeping. He knows if you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. I mean, I was like, well, he's quite omniscient. And not only is he's omniscient and really good. He brings me stuff. And he wants me to be good like him. I had all this evidence for Santa Claus. And virtually no evidence for God, except that every Sunday morning for a little less than an hour, we would go to the very boring Lutheran church, do a liturgy, and go home. And that was God. But Santa was pervasive. Santa was all the way through the society. And I didn't care what kind of Christian you were, you believed in Santa. Every group of Christians could unite around the Santa Claus idea. So I really bought the whole Santa Claus thing. I had all this evidence for Santa Claus. I had virtually no evidence for God. The Lutherans never taught me the Bible. They taught me the liturgy, and they taught me little, like I said, homiletic sermons, usually with 3 points, no more, oftentimes with a little mnemonic device. Every point begins with the letter P. And that was about all you'd get out of church. You'd go home with that and then, you know, look for gifts. So I decided quite early on that if I ever did have children, that I was never going to take them through that same thing I went through. And I was quite fortunate that once Libby and I had kids, we sat down and discussed it. And we said, well, are we going to do the Santa Claus thing? Quite fortunately, she agreed. And we said, okay, no Santa Claus. We're not going to do Santa Claus. We're going to let them know who Santa Claus is. But my kids know who Santa Claus is on the same level that they knew who Ronald McDonald. Well, that was a tough one because that was Grandpa. But But they knew, yeah, Bugs Bunny, Mickey Mouse, Daffy Duck, Santa Claus, they knew who these fictional characters were. And I was not a complete Scrooge about it. We very often had trees. They always had gifts. They always had way too many gifts. But they saw the gifts piling up over the course of the weeks leading to Christmas. So there was all that anticipation. They didn't have to wait for Christmas Eve to see what gifts would show up. And so we had our own family traditions of how we did Christmas. So we took a certain amount of heat for that. And, you know, you'd go to work and you'd tell folks, so they'd say, well, what is Santa bringing your kids? And we would say, we don't teach our kids Santa Claus. And they would flip out.
Yeah, it's taking the magic away from the children.
And you're destroying their imagination. And how can you take Santa Claus away from kids? Oh, it's one of the most wonderful times ever, blah, 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 blah. So as I grew older and became more committed to the Bible and began reading it, I came across things like Jeremiah making fun of people for bringing a tree into their house, decorating it with gold and silver and bowing down and worshiping it. And he makes fun of them. And he says, because it's a tree, it can't even stand up. You have to nail it to a piece of wood to make it stand up. It can't speak, it can't talk. And yet people bring them into their house and decorate them like they're some special thing. So I started having a little conflict with the whole Christmas tree idea. As I continued reading and reading the history of Baal, or Baal, the sun god, and the more I began reading about the traditions of Christmas, I realized that most Christmas traditions go all the way back to Babylonish sun worship. And if I were to walk in here one day and say to you, hey, listen, I've got this great idea. I learned this thing that they used to do in Babylon, where they used to worship Tammuz and Baal, his father, and it all revolves around Semiramis, who's a goddess, and it's okay. Her name is also Ishtar, and we're going to have a big feast here at the church to the sun god, okay? And you'd all go, well, no, Jim, that's repulsive. Why would we do such a thing? That's Christmas. That's what it is. And so I have a difficulty now where I try to see the world every day, not just during the holidays, but I try to see the world as much as I can from a biblical perspective and from God's perspective. And I can only imagine, knowing that God is everywhere and sees everything, and every once in a while, I bump into things that I find completely repulsive. Have you ever had that experience where, like, you speak to someone or you see something on the TV or something where you go, really, there are people like that? And it's repulsive to you. You can only imagine how repulsive it must be to God. But now, 1/12th of our calendar year, starting from Thanksgiving all the way through to December 25th and then into the beginning of the new year, 1/12th of our calendar year is devoted to a Babylonish sun worship feast, the Saturnalia feast that occurred during the shortest day of the year, right around December 25th. And it was all about beckoning to the unconquerable sun, S-U-N, to return so there'd be longer days so that you could have harvests and you could have plenty and there'd be plenty to eat. So during the short winter days, they would have this feast to the unconquerable sun, S-U-N. So this feast was so entrenched in Roman cultic society that when Christianity became the state religion, over the course of time, some people automatically say that this was Constantine's work, may or may not have been his direct work, but over the succession of he and then progressively more Christian-friendly emperors, the holidays that were already being celebrated in Rome anyway were simply stamped with Christian ideas. And so the idea that Jesus was born on December 25th, the shortest day of the year, was stamped onto the Saturnalia feast, and so it became the Christ Mass. You all know the word mass comes from the word massa, the little round cakes in the shape of the sun that are baked to the Queen of Heaven. And that word is very common among the Catholics who call their services a mass. And so the Christ Mass was stamped onto the Saturnalia short day feast. And instead of being a feast to the unconquered sun, S-U-N, it was to the unconquered sun, S-O-N, and then it became the birth of Jesus. And then legend grew up around that. The movie that's out right now, the Nativity movie, have you seen anything about it? I saw a trailer for it recently. And in the climactic scene, they have the manger, very much like any manger you would see on anybody's lawn. And they've got the shepherds there, and they've got the Mary and Joseph there with the baby in the manger, with the direct from Hollywood Cleve light coming down on the baby in the manger so that you know that's him. And then they have the wise men there. You know that there were no wise men in the manger when Jesus was laying there, right? If you know anything about your Bible, you know that the wise men didn't show up till he was 2 years old, and they found him in the house where Mary and Joseph lived. They were never there at the manger. And by the way, there weren't three of them. We get this idea that there were three of them because we sang, "We three kings of Orient are." So next thing we know, we've got three kings coming in. The Bible doesn't say there were three of them. It doesn't say they're kings. It says they're magi. They're from the east. They were probably from Babylon. How would they know about the birth of Christ? Well, they had Daniel to refer to. Daniel had already predicted the exact number of days it was going to be until the Christ was going to be born. They had information to work with. They weren't just, you know, on this sort of trek on their camels, the three of them with their fine regalia looking for the Jesus baby. That didn't happen. But even in a movie that is now being touted as the most biblical telling of the nativity story, because people's tradition is so thick, I think the producers realized that if they had left the three kings out of the story and put them where they belonged, people would go, "Oh, well, I don't like this movie anymore." So you got to put them in there. I'm surprised they didn't have a little drummer boy in there. I'm surprised. The traditions run so thick. In the 1800s, in the United States of America, look it up, read your history, Christmas was outlawed in the United States. In the original colonies, if you did not show up for work on Christmas Day, that was a fireable offense because they assumed you were at home keeping a pagan tradition. Once upon a time, the Puritans in America understood that Christmas had its pagan roots. Now Christmas is so entrenched in the economy of America, the vast majority of retailers operate in the red right up until Thanksgiving. That's why they talk about Black Friday. You've heard about that, right? The day after Thanksgiving, the busiest shopping day of the year. That's the day that retailers go into the black for the first time in the year. And everything they make from Thanksgiving until the end of the year, they're finally in profit. So you are never going to be able to get that economic engine, you're never going to get that removed from our society now, even though at one time we understood its pagan roots. So as I was saying, when I try to look at it from a biblical view or look at it from God's point of view, I can only imagine that God finds it at best really disturbing that 1/12 of the calendar year, at a time that was dedicated to the worship of the sun, that everybody's attention turns to Santa Claus. Now, there are ancient wood carvings. I brought some stuff last year when I was going through the history of Christmas, and you can go back and find that CD if you want to listen to all of it. But there are old wood carvings of Baal, of Baal, what he looked like. Surprise, guess what he looks like? Looks like Santa Claus. Yeah, a guy with a long white beard, usually holding a fir tree in his hand, an evergreen, a sign of everlasting life, and he usually has a deer with him. And so we've just taken that old Babylonish custom and tradition, the worship of the sun god Baal, and we've just imported into our house and convinced our children that this is real so that they can have imagination and fun at Christmas time. Again, try to think from God's perspective. Do you really think he's enjoying that? Considering how much of the Bible is dedicated to don't worship other gods. So not only have we taken Santa Claus, who is Baal, and brought him into our homes and society, but we have also given him omniscience. He knows when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, and we've made him the judge of good and evil. He knows if you've been bad or good, be good for goodness sake. We've also made him the arbiter of gifts, and he gives gifts to good children, and he punishes the bad children, and you get coal and sticks. All this legend that we've built around Baal, I can't help once I knew all that information. Once I reached the point where I knew all that info, I couldn't help but let that influence the way I view Christmas. So that's my deal with Christmas, since you asked. I'm not a big Scrooge about it. I mean, if you want to have a tree in your house, have a tree in your house. Just don't invite me over. If you want to, it's a joke. It's completely a joke. If you want a tree, have a tree. I dropped by Renee's the other day. Renee has this lovely, what is that tree you've got?
It's like a palm tree.
It's like this palm tree she's got in her dining room, and she put lights on it. And I said, "Christmas tree?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "I'd leave that lit all year round. That's really pretty. She did a real nice job with the palm tree." So if you want to have a Christmas tradition, whatever your family tradition is, that's fine. But know the truth and then determine, right, and he wasn't born on December 25th. You want me to prove that to you real fast, that Jesus wasn't born on December 25th?
Yeah.
Okay. We're in the Northern Hemisphere. Where is Israel? Northern Hemisphere. In December, in Israel, there are no shepherds watching their flocks by night. they don't take the sheep out in the fields in the middle of winter. Doesn't happen. That should be enough to prove it to you. But if you follow Luke's reckoning, you can get a pretty good feel for when John the Baptist was born. John the Baptist was 6 months older than Jesus. And that puts Jesus' birth right around September, right around Feast of Trumpets. If it were right around Feast of Trumpets, then every Jew that could travel would have had to travel and would have had to have been in Jerusalem. That would explain why there was no room at the inn and why Jerusalem was overflowing with people. It all makes sense. And so my point is this. Have your traditions, enjoy it. Here's one tradition I'm all in favor of, just so you know. If you decide, hey, it's Christmas, we ought to get Jim a gift, I'm with you. I'm completely good with that.
As long as it's sanctified, right?
Please. I'm not even that picky. Just get me something. So, you found a cross-shaped Christmas tree. The folks at the end of my street put up their manger scene, and they always have the three wise men and everybody there and stuff. And then right outside the manger is Santa's sleigh, and Santa is standing over the manger almost like he's blessing the manger scene. And I mean, the intermingling, the intermixing of man-made tradition and Babylonish tradition and then the idea of Christ's birth, these two things have been crammed together in ways that are so completely inappropriate from a biblical point of view. All those bumper stickers that say, keep Christ in Christmas, I just kind of chuckle at them and I go, he wasn't in it. He's not in it. It's the Christ Mass, but I understand that that's just people's traditions. But it is such a pervasive tradition. Here's my point. It is such a pervasive tradition that people will fight for their Christmas traditions faster than they'll fight for genuine Christianity.
That's right.
You go out and try to argue real biblical Pauline Christianity to people. People are very lackadaisical about that stuff. But try to take Santa Claus away from people. Try to take Christmas away from people. They will fight you tooth and nail for it. So I know that, you know that, you all agreed to it, and so if that's true, from God's perspective, how really repulsive must that be? That people will fight for Christmas faster than they'll fight for the reality of God and His Christ. But that's the world we live in. And so I've made jokes before that from Thanksgiving until about the 4th, 5th of January, just expect that I'm going to be difficult to get along with. I fall into this sort of weird depression during that period. It doesn't have to do with the darkness or the short days. It's just that I can't even go out to stores without the constant imagery and reminder and music of it's the Christ Mass, it's the Christ Mass, it's the Christ. And so I just don't leave my house. I hunker down and just wait for it to pass because I find it bothersome. But again, I'm going to say my same point again. Know the truth. Mm-hmm. The truth will set you free. And know the truth, and then to whatever degree you can enjoy your family stuff and your traditions, I'm fine. Acts 12, turn there. I just wanted to one time publicly answer the question, what is your deal with Christmas?
And I actually heard Deborah approach you about that. What she actually said was, O kind sir, from whence cometh this dissident spirit?
From whence cometh this dissident spirit? It's going to be very difficult to get you into Acts 12 in the mindset I've put you in now, but at Acts 12, now that we've got Paul and Barnabas up in Antioch and we've got believers being called Christians for the first time in Antioch, at that point, Luke, in his narrative, takes a moment to go back to Peter. He had already introduced Peter, and Peter had gone to the house of Cornelius, and he had seen Gentiles converted. And he had gone back to Jerusalem and talked about it, and then we made the jump to talking about Paul and Barnabas. So now, at the beginning of chapter 12, he talks about Peter again. In the next two chapters, really, what we're going to see, and I think this is what Luke is trying to point out to Theophilus, I always try to get at the core of the letter. Why is this in here? What was Luke trying to express to Theophilus? What we're going to see is persecution against the Christian message. And we're going to see the persecution come from three different sources as the gospel goes out. The first place that we're going to see the persecution arise is going to be from the government, because Christianity at this point, at this time, was really stirring up the Middle East, was really stirring up Judea. And there were conflicts that arose even in the area of Rome to the point where all the Jews were banned from Rome just to keep the discussions and genuine riots that broke out and sometimes keep those to a minimum, because Christianity was starting to really upset people, especially converted Jews and unconverted Jews arguing against each other, and then converted Jews arguing against converted Gentiles, and they had their problems. And so there was a lot of just social upheaval that was happening as a result of the spread of the gospel. And so government officials got involved in trying to keep this message down. Part of the reason that we're going to see Herod Antipas in a minute, one of the reasons that he is going to try to suppress this message as well, is that his base, he gets his security and kingship, his base, from the Jews, the largely unconverted Jews. And so in order to keep peace with those who are the largest part of his population base, he's willing to persecute Christianity. The next place that we're going to see persecution against the message is going to be from a sorcerer, which is interesting because he's sort of representative of other religions, New Age type stuff, witchcraft, sorcery, all that stuff that is still spiritual in some aspect, but not genuinely Christian. And I think we see to this day that there continues to be that spirit of opposition from people who say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not Christian, as if being spiritual is sufficient. The third place where we're going to see the persecution come then is from other religious people, from the people whose religion and particularly tradition is being threatened by the preaching of salvation by grace through faith, which undermines all of their religious exercise and enterprise and undermines their power base. Because anytime you can exercise authority over people, you can gain power, money, wealth to yourself. And nothing works better when you're trying to assimilate power to yourself than to have the cloak of religion around you so that you can put rules and regulations on people and tell them if they break your rules, you have the power of God behind you and you can condemn them to hell, and that's a lot of power. And so we're going to see that as Paul goes in and preaches salvation through faith in Christ, that the Jewish leaders are going to get upset because he's undermining their power base. So the three places in the next two chapters that we see opposition come from are the same three places we still see the opposition come from. It's going to come from the government. Government is always going to be bothered by the idea of genuine Christianity, because Christianity does speak of individual freedom where you and God work it out between the two of you, and you don't need any authority, you don't need any president, you don't need any senator, you don't need any go-between, you don't need any governmental authority to help you in your religion. And especially if you think pre-America, at least in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, in the founding documents for America, at least our founders had the wisdom to say that the government was not going to establish any religion. And the idea behind the Establishment Clause was that government was not going to make a state church, because every large society, especially England, where so many of the founders had come from, the king was the head of the Church of England. So you got this intermingling of ecclesiastical and political power, and as soon as you get those two things mixed together, you can use the power of the state and the power of the sword in order to convert people to your religion. So then you not only control them socially and politically, you can control their conscience through the use of the oppression of the sword. And that's the long, rich history of politics and religion in the world prior to the United States. We, as United States citizens, have grown up with a certain amount of individual freedom that we're just accustomed to. If we don't like our leaders, 4 years later, we just vote them out. And so it's very hard for us to conceive of living in a society where the church and the government are one and the same. So the government, that's the first place that we see persecution. Always has been, always will be. As we read through Paul writing to the Thessalonians, as you read through the book of Revelation, the Antichrist or the little horn or the political leader who's going to rise up to persecute the church, that's the back he rides on, politics, government, authority. So that's always going to be in opposition to the church. The second place, of course, is New Age stuff. To this day, we still see New Age spirituality posed against Christianity. And the more celebrities and pop stars we have who use the language of spirituality while at the same time decrying and making fun of Christianity, Madonna comes to mind, only because this is a perfect example. There's been a lot of controversy lately about her most recent concert tour where she hangs herself on a big glittery cross. And yet, you know, this is the same Madonna that spent all that time in Jerusalem studying Kabbalah and these kind of things, because she will tell you, I'm very spiritual. But she's willing to also make fun of Christianity, because Christian doctrine says there is a truth, you need to know that truth, and you need to rest your eternity on the basis of knowable truth, as opposed to spirituality that says whatever feeling you have and you just converse with the trees and whatever you can get out of watching a wave roll in or whatever you can get out of mystical, numerological type things, that's all valid too, and God will somehow be okay with that. If you can go and say, look, I was sincere and I was spiritual, supposedly God's going to go, oh, okay, you tried. By the way, is the devil spiritual?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's pretty spiritual. Sure. In fact, James writes, you say you believe in God. You say there is one God. You do well. And then he goes on and says, the devils also agree with that. And they tremble. They shudder. Because they know the reality of God, and it scares them. Human beings know the reality of God and think that just because they say, well, there is a God, that somehow that makes them okay with God. They go, well, there is a God. There is also knowable, revealed doctrinal truth, and you have to base your spirituality on that knowable truth. And then third, of course, religious persecution. Anybody got a problem with that one? I think we all know that's where the persecution comes from. You stand for the truth, you stand for Christ, salvation by grace through faith. The first people who will get riled at you for that is people who have religious tradition, and you are undermining their tradition by saying, you know, I don't need all the trappings of religion that you keep putting in front of me. I have Christ, and I don't need anything beyond that. And I have faith in his finished work, and I don't need anything beyond that. And they get really unhappy with you. You had your hand up.
Yeah, I was going to say what you were talking about as far as the demons believing and trembling. You know, what they believe is accurate. You could say it's orthodox. So orthodoxy, or believing the right things, or knowing the right things, I guess maybe a better way to put it, is not salvation. Our perverted, sinful, fallen nature can take truth and agree with it and yet not embrace it and not be transformed by it and still be damned and under God's judgment.
I've gone through that discussion with folks before where I'll ask the question, you know, do you believe in God and do you think that's sufficient? Because most people, if you press them to the wall, put a gun to their head and say, do you believe in God? They're going to say, well, yes, I believe in some sort of God. And they think that's sufficient, that when they die, they're going to be okay because they believe in God, whatever that means. So when you take them to the Bible and say, okay, the devil also believes and trembles. So you're really doing no better at this point than any devil in hell. And by the way, everybody in hell believes in God. Right?
Yep.
They're sure he exists. They're under his judgment. They believe in God. So then people will say, well, I believe in Jesus. Like, I admit that Jesus existed, that he lived, that I believe in him as a person, as a philosopher, as a teacher. Okay, Tacitus, the Roman historian, agreed with that. Josephus agreed with that. These were not saved people, but they agreed he existed and that he was a rabbi, a teacher in Israel. So then you even get people who say, well, I worship some form of Jesus. I have some concept of who he is. I don't spend a lot of time in the Bible, but I worship Jesus. The demoniac at the Gadarenes had a demon in him called Legion that bowed down in front of Jesus and worshiped. So, okay, I worship Jesus. So do demons. And so it's really as particular as you were making it out to be. It's got to go all the way to, do you have faith in God? Are you indwelt by the Holy Spirit of God, which produces that faith? And only if the Spirit of God lives in you and you have faith in the finished work of Christ to redeem you, only then can you say, I'm now doing something the devils can't do. There's no devil out there that has faith in the finished work of Christ to redeem and save them. And there's no devil out there that is indwelt by the Holy Spirit. So only if you can say, I, in a real, genuine, biblical Christian way, am spirit indwelt, blood bought, and redeemed by the finished work, are you doing anything that isn't done by devils? All right, so let's start chapter 12. Now we're talking about what happened to Peter. This is a great story for you kids who haven't read Acts 12. This is just a great narrative that Luke added into his letter to Theophilus. And I want you to put flesh and blood on this for a moment. It's easy to just read through the Bible and go, yeah, that's a little story that happened. Put flesh and blood on it for a moment. Persecution has begun. Chapter 12, verse 1. Now about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church, and he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. Why did he do this? The next verse says, and because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further. So in order to, again, kind of secure his base, the Jews in that area, he killed James, the brother of John. Now, this is not the James who wrote the book of James that you find in the New Testament. James, who became one of the three Jerusalem leaders, Peter, John, and James, is actually the brother of Jesus. Now, Herod at this point is not the same Herod who went after Jesus as a baby. There was this guy, Herod the Great. And when the Magi from the East came searching for the Christ child, they thought, well, Herod, the king of this area, is going to know where the child's being born. I mean, after all, he would know his Old Testament. Herod the Great, by the way, though he was a king over Jewish people, was himself a Dumian. He was not a true Jew. And his son, who we're going to talk about in a moment, often tried to pass himself off as Jewish. And he would keep Passover, and he would keep Feast of Trumpets and stuff, and he would try to pass himself off. But the Jewish people never really trusted him. His dad, Herod the Great, did a lot of great stuff in the Middle East. For instance, he built a city, Caesarea, which was a port city, and he built one of the most amazing man-made harbors in all of history, where he built a stone wall out into the seabed and created a man-made harbor, much of which still stands to this day. So he was a very industrious king, and he's the one who built the temple in Jerusalem that Jesus was walking in. That was known as Herod's temple. Herod the Great is the one who, when the Magi from the East came and said, where is this child who will be king of the Jews? Well, that's a big problem for this guy, Herod, because he's king of the Jews, and now he's being told that there's a prophetic child being born who's going to rise up to be king of the Jews. Now, Herod has children. He has sons, one of whom is this Herod we're going to talk about in a moment. And he wants his sons to proceed on the throne. He wants the Herodian family to continue on the throne. So he devises a plan. He tells the Magi from the East, when you find the child, come and tell me, because I'd like to come worship him too. And then we find out in Matthew that what he really wanted was to go kill the child. That's what he was really after. And so when he realizes he's been hoodwinked, and when the Magi from the East hear that they're not to go back to Herod, it says that they go home a different way once they've found the child who's about 2 years old. Well, Herod starts doing some figuring, has asked them when they first saw the star that appeared that they were following, starts doing some figuring and figures that this child, this king of the Jews child, is about 2 years old, and so he puts out a decree to kill all the children 2 years and younger because he figures if he gets rid of all the kids, he'll get rid of that child. Well, that's when an angel comes to Mary and Joseph and says, take the baby and head for Egypt. And so Mary and Joseph grab Jesus, they head for Egypt, and there is what's called the slaughter of the innocents, and all the babies in the area are killed. Then Herod dies. And when Herod dies, his son, Herod Antipas the First, becomes the king. Now, we know a lot about this guy, the son, this Herod Antipas guy. To begin with, He marries first an Arab princess. Then he divorces her so that he can marry a woman who had divorced his brother. So now he's marrying his sister-in-law. Now that's not peculiar enough, but she is also his niece. And so he marries his niece who was previously married to his half-brother. So it's his niece sister-in-law. That's the Herod who is by the side of the River Jordan when John the Baptist goes after him and says, it's not right for you to have your brother's wife as your wife. And Herod takes to this so well that he has John the Baptist brought in. And this woman has a daughter. And it turns out that apparently Herod is kind of lecherous, as I guess we could figure out by his marriage choices. So the daughter comes out and dances for Herod Antipas. And he likes the dance so much that he says, I'll give you whatever you want. And she had already conspired with her mother, who hated John the Baptist, for pointing out that it wasn't right for the two of them to be married. And she says to the daughter, go tell him you want the head of John the Baptist on a plate. And so Herod Antipas, not strong enough to stand up to his wife and her daughter, kills John the Baptist. That's the same guy who kills James over here. I just want you to see that there's actually a consistent personality profile being drawn in the scripture of this Herod Antipas. This is not a good guy. This is not a nice fellow. So he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also, and then were the days of unleavened bread. What are the days of unleavened bread? Well, the week of unleavened bread. Passover is the first day of the week of unleavened bread. So the feast of unleavened bread is there. This is what's sort of saving Peter at the moment. You get from the text that it was Herod's intention, having killed James, to then get Peter, kill him, and just probably from there, John, and just start wiping out the leaders of the Jerusalem church one by one. But remember that even Pilate, because it was Passover, brought Jesus out with Barabbas. Remember the Jewish leaders arguing amongst themselves and saying, you know, we want to kill this Jesus, but we can't do it on the Passover. And then, of course, Jesus died on the Passover because that's what was prophesied. So since it was a Jewish feast, it was the wrong time for a political leader to kill a Jew. And so that's why it's included here that he took him and he proceeded further to take Peter also. But then were the days of unleavened bread. So instead, Peter ends up being put in prison. But he wants to make sure and really secure Peter. So picture this. When he had apprehended him, he put him in prison, and he delivered him to four, the King James says, quaternions of soldiers. In other words, four groups of four soldiers. Herod was so determined to catch Peter and keep Peter, he put 16 Roman centurions on him. We do not want this guy getting away. So they put him in chains and put 16 guards around him just to make sure he was really secure. So get the picture. Chains, prison, 16 guards. Verse 4, when they had apprehended him, they put him in prison, delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending after... How many people here have a King James in the room? What's the word in the King James? Not the New King James. What's the King James say?
Easter.
Easter. What a peculiar translation. The word is Pascha there. It's Passover.
The New King James says Passover.
As every other translation does, because they realize that if you're going to translate the word is Passover. The King James translators, here's another place where you do have to spend a little bit of time comparing translations against translations, and as much as you can going back to original language and paying attention. By the time King James had commissioned the Bible in English that is called the King James Version, the 1611 King James, by that time Easter was being already celebrated as a feast, the spring feast to Ishtar, which is where the name Easter comes from. And so that tradition was so entrenched that to do a little pleasure for the king, they managed to get the word Easter in the Bible somewhere. So that when you talk to people and argue with people about Easter and you say, well, you know, Easter is also a feast to Ishtar, Semiramis, it goes all the way back to Babylon, rushing out at sunup to worship the sun as it rises, which is why there's sunup services now. And you say that to people, they go, no, 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 Easter's in the Bible. Easter's in the Bible. Well, it's only in the King James Bible because of a terrible mistranslation that is not even a translation. It is imposing a word into the text to try to legitimize a pagan feast. But he intended after Passover to bring him forth to the people. Peter, therefore, was kept in prison, but prayer was made for him without ceasing of the church unto God for him. And when Herod would have brought him forth, the same night Peter was sleeping between two soldiers. He was bound with two chains, one to each soldier, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. This guy's secure. Not only is he chained, he was chained to two soldiers, and two other soldiers are watching the door of the prison, and he's asleep. There's no chance of escape. When suddenly, verse 7, behold, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shone in the prison, and he struck Peter on the side and woke him up, saying, arise up quickly, and his chains fell off from his hands. And the angel said unto him, gird yourself, that means get dressed, bind on your sandals, and so he did. And the angel said, cast your garment about thee, and follow me. And he went out, and he followed him, and he did not know what was true about these things that were being done. He didn't understand the things that were happening with the angel. He thought maybe he was seeing a vision, because he'd just been asleep, so he wasn't still sure if this was a dream or if it was really happening. And when they were past the first and the second ward, they came unto the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened to them of its own accord. And he went out, and he passed on through one street, and forthwith the angel departed from him. And that's the point at which Peter realizes it's actually true. It's actually real. I'm standing here in the middle of Jerusalem. Now, think about it for a moment. Apparently, none of the guards woke up. Or the guards that were guarding the door just went stupid, or went blind, or became suddenly comatose. Something happened where Peter's chains fell off. He stood up, and he walked out of that place as doors opened, the first ward, the second ward, out into the street, and nobody else seemed to know what was going on. Now, when Luke writes this to Theophilus, think about it from Theophilus' point of view. Not only is this another miraculous deliverance, another miracle being done by angels on behalf of the gospel, but one more time we see particularity. And particularity runs all the way through these Gospels and through Luke's account. Did an angel appear in the prison according to Luke? Yeah. Who saw him? Everybody? No. You didn't see the guards jump up and go, get him! There's an angel, he's trying to get Peter. He's trying to, hey, they didn't pull out, so stop him! The way Luke writes it, this was a very calm event. He even had to roust Peter to get him to come. Hello, wake up. Come with me. I wasn't to you directly. But I mean, he had to roust him and pull him out and say, come on, come on, get your clothes, get your shoes, we're going. Which means that he communicated with Peter and nobody else heard it. Everybody else was there. Nobody else heard it. Now, I keep contending over and over and over again that the God of the Bible is particular. That the God of the Bible is under no obligation nor compunction to reveal himself to absolutely everybody all the time. That he has the ability, and in fact a long, rich history, of dealing with particular people. Like Paul being converted on the Damascus Road. Only Paul heard the voice. Only Paul was converted. Others traveling with Paul, they saw the light. They heard Paul responding to something. They couldn't make out what was going on. It was all mysterious to them, but God dealt with Paul individually. Here he's dealing with Peter individually while Peter is chained to and surrounded by enemies. Nevertheless, God can get to him, talk to him, deliver him. Should I make application?
Hold on, Jim, before you do that same analogy going on where you've got the guards there, what a testimony that would have been to the guards. Oh, look, the angels, wow. Yeah. But you do see that with Paul and Silas with the Philippian jailer.
Right.
Sure enough, salvation comes to his home
right
after that. So.
But that's particular, isn't it? Why the Philippian jailer and not these Roman guards? Right. Why at that moment as Peter was being delivered? I mean, there's an angel of the Lord there. Jeff's right. What a great testimony to these Romans if they had woken them all up and said, look, it's an angel of the Lord come to deliver Peter because the angel of the Lord believes in what Peter's doing and he's promoting this gospel, and how dare you restrict it? You need to be converted too. All of that seeker-friendly, seeker-sensitive type stuff. None of that. It leaves them in their ignorance. In fact, it was a rule that if you were a Roman guard and you lost a prisoner, you had to pay whatever penalty that prisoner was supposed to pay. Because you lost your prisoner. Well, Peter was going to be killed. So these men are now in threat of their life. The angel knew that when he took them and just left them there in their blindness, their ignorance.
Which is why that one with Paul and Silas, he was about to fall on his sword.
Absolutely.
He knew his doom.
With Paul and Silas, he was ready to kill himself, and then Paul cries out and says, "Don't do yourself any harm. We're all still here." Why were they still there instead of delivered like this? Because the Philippians...
Salvation was supposed to come to his home.
Absolutely. Salvation was going to come to his home. That's particularity. You can't see it any other way. And so, verse 9, he went out and he followed him. He wasn't sure if it was true what was being done by the angel. He thought it was a vision. They went past the first and second ward. They came under the iron gate that leads unto the city, which opened to them of its own accord. They went out. They passed on through one street, and forthwith the angel departed from him. And when Peter was come to himself, he said, "Now I know of a surety that the Lord sent this angel and has delivered me out of the hand of Herod and from all the expectation of the people of the Jews." And when he had considered the thing, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark. This is John Mark, or the Apostle John, where there were many gathered together praying. I can't help it. I find this funny. Luke included this in his letter to Theophilus. I find it humorous. The people who were praying for Peter's well-being and release are inside the house. And they are praying fervently to God that he will either protect Peter or deliver Peter, do something about Peter's situation right now. And they're all in there fervently praying. Peter's outside trying to get their attention. And they refuse to answer the door or believe it's him because they're so busy praying that God will do something about Peter. It's just funny. And when he had considered the thing, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where there were many people gathered together praying. And as Peter knocked at the door of the gate, a damsel came to hearken, whose name was Rhoda. And when she knew Peter's voice, she did not open the gate for gladness. But she ran inside and told the group inside that Peter stood outside by the gate. And they said unto her, "You're crazy." "You are mad," they argued. But she constantly affirmed that it was even so. And then they argued, "Well, then it is his angel. It is his messenger. It is his protector. But it can't possibly be Peter." Now, all this time that they're indoors arguing, Peter's still at the gate. She heard his voice. She knew it was him. She went inside and tried to tell them, "Peter's at the gate." They're inside arguing. He's still standing out there. So Peter continued knocking. Verse 16. He's still out there banging on the gate. "Come on, guys, it's me." Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened and they saw that it was him, they were astonished. But he, beckoning unto them with his hand, told them to hold their peace. And he declared unto them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, "Go show these things unto James." See that? Now, we just read at the beginning of this very chapter that Herod had killed James, the brother of John. So here when it says, "Go show these things to James," we're talking about a different James. We're talking about the brother of the Lord here. He said, "Go show these things to James and to the brethren." And then he departed and went into another place. He told them what had happened, and off he went, realizing that the angel had brought him out of the prison for a purpose. He didn't settle on his lease and go, "Well, I'm delivered. Let's party." Yes, ma'am.
How come you don't see angels like come in vision and do this thing in these days now? Why was it always back then?
You know, that kind of goes into what we've discussed a lot concerning spiritual gifts. Why don't you see people raised from the dead much anymore? Why don't you see speaking in tongues much anymore? Yeah, much. Did I qualify that? Why don't we not see people raised from the dead anymore? I'll take the much out of that sentence. And there are a lot of different theological discussions and disagreements about why that is. If you're pragmatic at all, you realize that is the case. That is how it goes now. I would argue that it's because when the gospel was first going out and it was only a handful of people, it was necessary that that handful that had walked and talked with Jesus, who actually knew the truth, they didn't have it written down yet. Scriptures aren't written. The New Testament doesn't exist yet. It's an absolute necessity that these guys live and that they continue and that the church become firm, that the foundation of the church is built. And then by the time you get into the early church fathers and into the first and second century, you see far fewer accounts of angelic visitation or even tongues or gifts of healings. That kind of stuff seems to decrease as the church becomes more and more secure. So if you just put those pieces of evidence together and know that God is in control, then you would conclude that he had to protect the church and especially the apostles during the formation of the church. But now we have the New Testament. Now we have 2,000 years of testimony to the validity of the church. We have 2,000 years of Christian security and doctrine and growth. And so it's not necessary anymore for us to see the miraculous or to see healings arising from the dead in order to have faith in Christ. Even Jesus said to his apostles, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." And so he even knew there was going to be a day, a time, when people weren't going to see the same things the apostles got to see, and yet would have the same faith. And he pointed out that that was a great blessing. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, let's just try to finish up this section, and I'll let you go. Verse 16, Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened, they saw him, and they were astonished. He beckoned unto them with his hand to hold their peace. He declared unto them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. He said, "Go show these things to James and to the brethren." And then he departed and he went into another place. Now, as soon as it was day, there was no small stir among the soldiers about what had become of Peter. Of course there was. Sun up comes, the two guards he was chained to, who figured they could go to sleep. I mean, he's chained to us. He's not going anywhere. They wake up. He's gone. You can only imagine the stir. And so verse 19, when Herod wanted him, again, put flesh and blood on this. So Herod says, "Okay, that guy we captured, Peter, bring him to me." The king wants to see him. And then the word goes down the ranks, down to the soldiers, get Peter, down to the prison, get Peter, bring Peter to the king. The king wants to see Peter. And then you've got the two guys who are asleep on the ground who wake up with the chains on them and they look over where he used to be. He's not there. And the king wants him now. And they know the rule. You lose your prisoner, you pay his price. And when Herod had sought for him and did not find him, he examined all the keepers, and he commanded that they should be put to death. So all those guards that he had said, "Hold Peter," you would think 16 guys would be enough to hold a guy. And if you take the part of the story that we know, that an angel came and delivered him, think of it from Herod's point of view. Take all of the miraculous out of it, and what you've got is 16 guys who managed to lose a guy they were chained to. This is like the escape artist trick of the decade. Peter, 16 guards, disappears. So when he found him, when he found out that he was gone, he had the soldiers put to death, and he went down from Judea to Caesarea, and he stayed there. And Herod was highly displeased with them of Tyre and Sidon, but they came with one accord unto him, and they had made friends with this guy Blastus, who was the king's chamberlain, and they desired peace because their country was nourished by the kings. So in other words, you've got these cities, Tyre and Sidon, separate little countries that had been cursed in the Old Testament as well, and they were attacked during the time of Alexander the Great, and they have a long history, but they are dependent for their food supply on the areas of Galilee where Herod is tetrarch over that area. And so they want to make peace with the king. They want to make the king realize that they intend to be friends. So they've made friends with his chamberlain, this Blastus guy, and so they've arranged something through the chamberlain. Verse 21, upon a set day, Herod, arrayed in his royal apparel, sat upon his throne, and he made this oration unto the people of Tyre and Sidon, and the people gave a shout, because they want to make him happy, they want to please him. They all shout out, "It is the voice of a god and not of a man." So they start worshiping him as a god because they need the food. Now, when they started shouting, "It is the voice of a god and not a man," immediately, I think it's an interesting word in there, Luke says right away, immediately, in front of all those people, the angel of the Lord killed him because he did not give God the glory. They said, "It's the voice of a god," and he clearly went, "Why, yes, it is. You're fortunate to have me here. I am a god now." He was so happy to have been worshipped as a god among the people that God killed him for it. And the next phrase is just very, very interesting, because we do assume that when people die and are buried, that their bodies are worm food to some degree. But he says right here, because he did not give God the glory, God smote him and he was eaten of worms and he gave up the ghost. The imagery being that as soon as he fell dead, he was worm food in front of all the people. So that people wouldn't just go, oh, look, he had a heart attack. Oh, gee, the king fell down dead. It was that he fell down dead and was instantly being consumed by worms so that everybody would go, whoa, something different happened here. Something judgmental happened here. There must be a real God, and he just struck that man dead. But the word of God, look at the opposite now, the second half of that phrase, he died and gave up the ghost, but the word of God grew and multiplied. So this kind of goes to what you were asking, Renee. Here you see all these miracles where God is protecting his word, protecting his apostles, protecting his people, and at the same time, anybody who opposes them and has killed James, has killed John the Baptist, somebody who is in that kind of opposition to the work of God, God takes them out of the way. But the word of God grew and multiplied, and then Luke returns his attention to Barnabas and Paul. Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem, and then they took with them John, whose surname was Mark. And so now you've got John traveling with Paul and Barnabas. There's a powerful trio of men going out to travel. Next week we'll pick up at chapter 13 and find out what happens to that trio of men. And you're going to see the next level of opposition, which is going to come from the spiritual crowd. Any questions about that? Yes, sir.
In the New King James Version, on that verse 23, it says, and he was eaten by worms and died. And then in the margin it says, breathed his last. So I guess it would read, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. So you do not take that to be sequentially, almost as if it's some kind of sci-fi horror going on here where worms are eating him alive and he dies from the worms eating him.
I just think it's remarkable that Luke put it in that order.
It's just conjunctive and coterminous saying
it could be
happening together here.
It could be that he died and then he was put in the ground and then he was eaten by worms, but that's an assumption that anybody makes about anybody that dies. Why did Luke include that phrase in writing to Theophilus and say, God smote him and he was eaten by worms and he died and gave up the ghost? I see it as Luke saying something out of the ordinary happened here to this man to make a public display of God's judgment. Otherwise, why even include it? We see that he killed James, so James was dead, but he doesn't mention that James was eaten by worms after he was buried. I mean, that just is an assumption that dead people rot and decay.
There's also a note here. Is this the MacArthur Study Bible? It says, according to Josephus, Herod endured terrible pain for 5 days before he died.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I wonder if there might have been something going on with the worms even then.
Yeah.
I wonder what the people shouted when they saw him being eaten by worms.
Yeah, kind of hard to say. It's the voice of a God. Hold it.
He's a maggot tree.
Exactly.
What would better refute the idea that he was just a man than that he was being eaten by worms? I mean, that's the universal symbol of mortality in ancient literature.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially when you compare it, by the way, if you think about David writing about Christ and saying that he was not going to suffer corruption. A sign of his divinity is that he was not going to decay in the grave. And yet even before he hit the grave, Herod was already decaying. What an indication of mortality. Yes, absolutely.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.